A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state. The right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Thanks so much for tuning in to another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. My name is Cam Edwards. It is great to have you with us here today. A little bit of a change from what I had planned on doing. Hoping to talk with Sheriff Scott Jenkins in Virginia, but unfortunately the sheriff is actually doing some work, so he couldn't join me on the program today, but I'm hoping that we'll be able to have Sheriff Jenkins on the program here tomorrow on Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. He was there at the hearing in the Senate Judiciary Committee yesterday when four Senate Democrats joined with every Republican on the committee to vote down House Bill 961, Governor Ralph Northam's gun ban, magazine ban, suppressor ban, trigger activator ban. And I would love to talk with Sheriff Jenkins about what happened yesterday. And then, again, what's going to happen going forward? Sheriff Jenkins made national news when he talked about basically deputizing every county resident in order to avoid or bypass any sort of gun ban that would have been coming down the road, because that ban would not have applied to law enforcement. So Sheriff Jenkins said, well, deputize everybody. And they're law enforcement. Now they're exempt. What does he think about things like red flag laws, the gun rationing bills that we've seen here, bills that would criminalize parents who allow their minor children access to firearms for hunting or for self-defense? Hopefully, again, we'll get a chance to talk with the sheriff about that on tomorrow's program. But we do have some other news to get to, including some fallout in Virginia over that vote on House Bill 91 in the Senate Judiciary Committee. I mentioned that there were four Democrats who voted against that measure. We had heard three of them were opposed to the original language of House Bill 961, three of these committee members, Senator John Edwards, who's the chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee. Then there was Senator Cray Deeds. Senator Surville, Steve Surville, he voted against the measure, and nobody really expected him to do that. But for whatever reason, Chap Peterson, State Senate Democrat from Northern Virginia, is the one that is getting the lion's share of grief from members of his own party in the legislature. I want you to check out a couple of tweets. This from Amy Friedenberger, who's a reporter for the Roanoke, Virginia newspaper. And this was from a hearing that she was covering Tuesday morning in Richmond. She said a House panel dealing with guns killed a bill from Senator Chap Peterson that would have allowed part-time law enforcement to purchase their service firearms at retirement. Only full-time law enforcement officers can do so. Now, this passed out of the Senate 40-0. So it was unanimously approved by the state Senate. And then it was killed in a House committee today. Amy Friedenberger says people in the room, including gun control advocates who liked the bill, believe Democrats killed it because Peterson voted against the assault weapons bill yesterday. So in other words, this was the House Democrats' revenge against Chad Peterson. Oh, you voted against our gun ban bill? Well, we're going to kill this bill that received unanimous support from the Virginia State Senate. Now, here's the thing. Who's really hurt by this vote? Is it Chap Peterson? Not really. I don't think he's a part-time law enforcement officer. The people who are honestly going to be impacted by this are those part-time law enforcement officers who will not be able to purchase their service firearm when they retire. And Virginia House Democrats apparently don't give a damn about those individuals, because I don't think this is about public safety at all. In fact, I think they've proven it time and time again this session. This is not about public safety. This is about their petty personal politics. That's what this is about. And when Chap Peterson dared to vote against this gun ban bill because he didn't think it was a good idea. In fact, he told Fox and Friends earlier today he was surprised that it got out of the House and made it over to the Senate side. His Democratic colleagues now want to enact their revenge. Frankly, I got to say, pass the popcorn. As a Virginia resident, we've got less than a month to go in this legislative session. March the 7th is the final day of the Virginia legislative session. And the more infighting and the more bickering and the more vitriol there is between Democrats in the House and Senate, the better off I think it's going to be for gun owners. Because we've got a lot of bills, as we heard from Dave Adams yesterday, a lot of bills that are going to end up in a conference committee. The Senate version is going to differ from the House version. And then these Democrats in the House and Senate are supposed to get together and try to hammer out their differences. So I want this to be, I want this to be as ugly a fight as possible. I want there to be as much acrimony as possible because I don't want them to work well together to infringe on our right to keep and bear arms. I hope that when the House Democrats and the Senate Democrats sit down at a table across from one another, that they can come to any sort of agreement. That's what I'd love to see. Now, I suspect that we're probably not going to be that lucky, but it is kind of fascinating to see the infighting begin in the wake of the demise of House Bill 961 for the session. By the way, this comes back next year. All Peterson did was a vote to send this bill, and I think Craig Eves actually the one that offered up the amendment to send this legislation to the Virginia Crime Commission to be studied. So they didn't actually vote to kill the bill. They just voted to push it off to the Virginia Crime Commission, and it'll come back next year. But I can't imagine that with this move, House Democrats earned the support of Chad Peterson in 2021 for this gun ban bill. Now, in other news outside of the state of Virginia, we've got a Democrat debate coming up on Wednesday. I confess, I've skipped the last few Democrat debates. I've not watched them on TV. I've kind of covered them after the fact. But I'll be watching tomorrow night because for the first time, Michael Bloomberg is going to be on that debate stage, thanks to a new poll that came out just under the deadline for Wednesday's debate. It was a Marist poll showing him at 19%. I know. And that qualifies him to take part in tomorrow night's debate in Las Vegas, even though Michael Bloomberg is not actually on the ballot in the Nevada caucus, which will take place on Saturday. And by the way, that is shaping up to be a real show as well. They've got all kinds of problems with the app that they were going to use, which was designed by the same company that did the app in the Iowa Democratic caucus. So they pulled that back. They said, all right, now we're going to use this thing instead, but nobody's been trained on how to do it. I mean, this could be a gigantic cluster coming up on Saturday. And Bloomberg's not going to be a part of that. He, I believe, is not on the ballot in South Carolina. It's really the Super Tuesday states that he's focusing on. But he'll be on the debate stage for the first time. And I want you to take a look at the rise in Bloomberg in polling recently. This is from Real Clear Politics, the 2020 Democratic presidential nomination. You can see there, these are the last five polls. Bloomberg, in the last five polls, 15%, 11%, 16%, 12%, 19%. He is now solidly in third place in the Real Clear Politics polling average behind Bernie Sanders at almost 25%, Biden at almost 18%, and there's Michael Bloomberg at 14.5% in the Real Clear Politics average. Now, if you look at the graph over time, you can see this surge really beginning even before Biden started tanking. So I know this gets a little confusing here, but that green line at the top, that's Joe Biden. And you can see him tanking in polling just in the past week or so, national polling. Then you've got Bernie Sanders. He's the blue line. He's been up or down, but he's been trending up to kind of coincide with Biden's decline. And then that that orange line starts way down at the bottom, and then it just kind of spikes up over the last couple of weeks. That's Michael Bloomberg, who has spent now about $400 million in his presidential campaign since beginning his bid for president in late November. So if you think about that for a second, I think it was November 25th or 26th when he actually said, all right, I'm getting in. So you've got November to December, December to January. We're not even 3 months in, and Bloomberg has spent over $400 million, burning through more than $100 million a month, which admittedly is like pocket change to the billionaire, right? I mean, I don't care about how much money it's costing, but it is staggering, given the fact I think Donald Trump spent $400 million in the in his entire presidential campaign back in 2016. And I suspect that when Bloomberg's on the debate stage tomorrow night, he's going to get hit by his Democratic colleagues for trying to buy the election, as well as his support for things like stop and frisk. And you know, what's sad is that they're going to hammer Bloomberg for his stop and frisk policies in New York, but they're not going to hammer Bloomberg for the gun control laws that were enforced using stop and frisk. See, that's the problem. These are two sides of the same coin here. And, you know, I've had a lot of folks tell me, well, listen, there's nothing wrong with stop and frisk. I think if you go and you look at what happened in New York City with the stop and frisk policy, it was greatly abused, at the very least. I mean, we're talking about 4 out of 5 black residents or young black men in New York City being stopped and frisked every year. And according to the ACLU, less than 1% of the time did those stop and frisks actually lead to a weapon being discovered. So I'll be honest with you. I mean, I'm not a fan of Michael Bloomberg, but I'm also not a fan of how that policy was implemented in New York City. And certainly I'm not a fan of the gun laws that were enforced using this policy. But on that debate stage on Wednesday night, all of these candidates are going to say, well, listen, we love what you've done with gun control, Michael. That's not our problem. We love the gun control laws that you've put on the books in New York City, raising it from a misdemeanor to a felony to possess a firearm without a license. We love those laws. We just hate how you enforced them. That's basically going to be their argument. I think it's a crummy argument. I don't know about you, but let's talk about the actual laws that I believe had as big a disproportionate impact on young minority men in New York City as stop and frisk did. And to this day, these policies in New York State are still being used disproportionately, A, in New York City. We've covered this at Bearing Arms before. The SAFE Act, the gun control package that was passed in New York State in 2013, signed by Governor Cuomo, most of those arrests are taking place in New York City, not upstate New York. In fact, most of those arrests are taking place in 2 of the 5 boroughs of New York City, the Bronx and Brooklyn. And most of those arrests under the SAFE Act are for one specific part of the SAFE Act, the felony possession of a firearm without a license. Now, that was a misdemeanor in New York State up until the passage of the SAFE Act. It was a felony in New York City before then because Bloomberg got the law changed. But with the passage of the SAFE Act, New York State law was then changed to comport with New York City law. And those tougher penalties for possessing a firearm without a license now apply statewide, even though, again, most of the time they're only being used in New York City. The other day, I had the opportunity, I've talked about this a piece by Emily Bazelon at Slate a number of times at Bearing Arms. She did a piece where she covered the Brooklyn Gun Court. She actually wrote an entire book about it. She also did a podcast. And I actually had the chance to sit down and listen to this podcast over the course of, I guess it was like 3 hours or so, the other day. And it was fascinating. It really was. You know, a lot of the individuals that Emily covered and even spoke with were people who did not have serious criminal histories. They may have been going down that wrong road. In some cases, they may not have been hanging out with the best folks. They may have been getting themselves in some minor trouble, but these were not hardened criminals. And the only crime that they were charged with was possession of a firearm without a license. And they were facing, and many of them did, years in prison as a result of that. Something that is not even a crime in many states across the United States, something that is a misdemeanor in many others, or even a civil penalty in some states. But it's a 3.5-year felony sentence there in New York State. And that's all because of Michael Bloomberg. So I want to hear, and again, we're not going to hear this on the Democratic debate stage, unfortunately, but I want to hear some questions about directed to Bloomberg about not just stop and frisk, but about the laws that were enforced using stop and frisk. And if it doesn't happen during the Democratic debate, if Bloomberg does get the nomination, I guarantee you it will come up during the general election. Speaking of Bloomberg, I do want to get to a few emails. Robert writing in, he said, I thought you might get a chuckle out of this. Saturday afternoon, I got a text message from somebody claiming to be with the Bloomberg campaign asking for my support. This was my reply. Hell no, he said. I'm a conservative gun owner. Never contact me again. And tell little Mikey he is a twerp. Well, good for you, Robert. I've seen so many folks online saying that they are getting contacted via text from the Bloomberg campaign. That has not happened to me. I hope that it doesn't happen to me. If it does happen to me, I will probably paraphrase what you said, Robert. I might be a little bit more short and sweet than you were, but good luck, and hopefully they don't contact you again. I have some other emails to get to as well. David writing in says, I want to say I've listened to you for years, wanted to get some ideas on how to keep my new home from becoming anti-Second Amendment. I just moved to Utah from California for a new job. Congratulations, David. David says, I've enjoyed the freedom of my new home. I fear that anti-gun advocates will do to Utah as they're doing to states all over the country, like California. Any ideas on how to keep Utah free other than the normal of calling my reps and voting, which I plan on doing? He says, thank you and keep up the fight. My best to you and your family. I know what it's like to have a loved one with cancer. My father, mother, grandmother, grandfather are all cancer survivors. God bless you and your family. Well, David, thank you so much, sir, for your thoughts and your kind words. And as for keeping Utah Second Amendment friendly, you know, it sounds trite, but a lot of it is staying involved. It is voting. But I would say the other component to that is outreach, right? You got to get those folks who are not gun owners, don't know much about firearms. And it's not that you have to turn them into gun owners. You don't have to turn them into NRA members. You don't have to turn them into huge Second Amendment supporters. You just have to give them the information that they need to understand that gun control is not the way to go. And I believe that in order to do that, and I think this is one of the things that as gun owners, we sometimes are not so great at this, at our outreach efforts, because we tend to approach non-gun owners or people who disagree with us and who support gun control, and we tend to use the arguments on them that would work on us, as opposed to trying to put ourselves in their shoes. You know, this is a persuasion effort, ultimately. When we're talking about engaging in that outreach, we have to come to the people that we're trying to persuade from their perspective and not from our perspective. It's not about, well, you don't get the Constitution, you don't get the Bill of Rights. Are you a moron? Are you stupid? Are you anti-American? Okay, you're not going to persuade anybody that way, right? So the first thing that I would do, David, in having these types of conversations is simply ask. I mean, if somebody comes up to you and, David, why do you own a gun? You can answer, but the first thing that I would do is I would ask, why do you have a problem with that? And find out what they have to say. Don't interrupt. Listen. You know, we talk so much about talking, but there is, I think, incredible value in listening to the other side. I can have a conversation with somebody that I disagree with, and it can be a real conversation because I'll listen to what they have to say. I'll take that in. I'll think about it, and then I'll respond. And I think when you're talking about changing those hearts and minds when it comes to our right to keep and bear arms, that's something that we absolutely have to do. We have to listen to folks and find out why they feel the way they feel. And then we can talk with them in a way that hopefully will resonate with them. You know, I was having a conversation not long ago with somebody about red flag laws. And their support for red flag laws was really based on their belief that this would be helpful at preventing suicide. This is somebody that lost a loved one to suicide. It was not a firearm-related suicide, but it was a suicide. And their goal is to stop people from feeling that same pain of losing a loved one in that way. That's a genuine, heartfelt belief. And I'm not going to drag somebody for that. But my response was, you know what? I don't want to see suicide either. In fact, in Virginia, our suicide rates are climbing. Firearms are about half of all suicides in the state. And not only are firearm-related suicides increasing, but non-firearm-related suicides are increasing. And when you look at red flag laws, and you look at the states where they've been on the books the longest, places like Indiana and Connecticut, the research shows that gun-related suicides actually did decline in those two states once the red flag laws were put on the books. But the overall suicide rate increased even more. And so I don't believe that we should be trying to get people to kill themselves through another method. I believe that we should be trying to stop these individuals from taking their life in the first place. So that's one example of how, again, you can try to listen to what folks have to say, and then you know, maybe approach this from a slightly different angle. Anyway, best of luck to you, David. Stay involved, stay engaged, and you know, take those opportunities to make those outreach efforts whenever possible. All right, let's get to today's armed citizen story, our good deed of the day, our recidivist report. We will start there. You know, talk about New York State. How about this? CBS 6 in New York reporting that New York State has lost track of over 3,000 parolees, including some violent sex offenders. Yes, even while Governor Cuomo is so focused on you and other legal, law-abiding gun owners in the state of New York, you know, the folks that they're supposed to be keeping track of, they can't. Nearly 10% of the individuals who are under supervision in New York State have now become what they're called parole absconders. They're just, you know, they've quit contacting their parole officers, and the state basically has no idea where they are. Karen Ziegler is the director of the Albany County Crime Victim and Sexual Violence Center. She said, "I don't think anybody in the community is aware of that number." Well, they are now, thanks to CBS 6 in Albany. They said that they were alerted to one absconder who was on parole for manslaughter in New York City when the state lost track of him. Found later in Albany, rearrested in connection with the shooting of a 16-year-old. New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision says it arrested an average of 175 parole absconders every month in 2019, but the total number is still higher than it was 8 months ago, with thousands of parolees still unaccounted for. The acting commissioner, Anthony Annucci, was approached by CBS 6 at a public meeting, but CBS 6 says, quote, "His team of security tried to stop us from getting anywhere near him." When they did finally get to the commissioner, they say he would not get off his phone to acknowledge the questions from the press. They say, quote, "His staff directed us to call his public relations director, who a week before had declined our request for an interview. The agency did answer some of our questions by email." They say, for example, when a parolee cuts off a GPS device, quote, "If there is a known threat to a victim, then attempts would be made to notify them. But only if there's a known threat to the victim. Otherwise, meh, you're probably just on your own." Karen Ziegler says, "I don't think the victims are being told. I don't think they're being warned. I don't think that they're aware that their safety is being compromised." Wayne Spence, a parole officer, president of the New York State Public Employees Federation, representing 900 parole officers across the state, said that the public is, quote, "absolutely at risk when these parole absconders take off." He says that a loss of parole officers has led to an increase in absconders. The state has moved to eliminate 400 positions through attrition. And he said because of reductions, officers are overwhelmed with their caseloads. Going back to that a piece that I mentioned before from Emily Bazelon, this is something that she acknowledges as well, that a lot of these parole officers may have as many as 100 individuals that they're trying to keep track of, which is far beyond not only the national average, but far beyond what the recommendations are. You know, that it's simply impossible for the average parole officer to keep track of all of the people that they're supposed to be monitoring. But rather than the state actually addressing that, Governor Cuomo's decided to focus on you and me and other legal gun owners in the state and around the country. Speaking of legal gun owners in the state and around the country, let's turn now to our armed citizen story. Vancouver, Washington, where a homeowner fatally shot a suspected burglar. This from the Columbian newspaper, reporting on an incident that happened late Thursday night. Vancouver police responded to a burglary in progress. There was also a report of a disturbance with a firearm. An initial police bulletin said that the homeowner told responding officers that an unknown person had broken into his home. He ended up confronting the stranger with his legally owned firearm and then shot that intruder. The suspect reportedly charged at the homeowner, who then fired his weapon. Suspect fled out the door, collapsed behind the residence, according to local police. They say that they're continuing the investigation, but right now it indicates that the male suspect forced open a rear door of the residence by kicking it in and was inside that home when the homeowner confronted him. The alleged intruder pronounced dead at the scene. No further details have been released. The homeowner and his family were not injured, thankfully. We'll keep our eyes on the story and bring any more details as they become available. Finally, tonight, today, or this morning, whenever you might be catching the program. Finally, we've got our good deed of the day from Chattanooga, Tennessee, where a Chattanooga police officer stepped up in a big way to help out a family who were victims of a scam. Kelly Phillips reached out to the Chattanooga Police Department after her son ended up selling a gaming system on the app LetGo, but the money that he received was counterfeit. Kelly says that she had fallen on some hard times. Her son was simply trying to earn some money so that he could buy Christmas presents for his younger siblings. And she reached out to the Chattanooga Police Department to let him know what had happened. She got in contact with Officer Kevin Osborne. And Officer Osborne was touched by her story. He and other officers pitched in to buy her son a new PlayStation after that PlayStation that he had sold. He got that fake cash. A good deed was shared on Facebook. Strangers saw it, eventually befriended Kelly and helped her buy a car that could get her around. She said, "We've never had anything like that. Nothing reliable or even with heat or air conditioning for that matter. That's the first thing my son said. Does it have a heater?" Kelly was able to take part in a recent event there with News Channel 9 where basically the TV station threw a dinner party for Officer Osborne with the help of Kelly Phillips and those community members who were so touched by this. She actually was able to give $500 through the McMahon Law Firm and News Channel 9 to Officer Osborne. She said, I want to thank you, show my gratitude to you, God working through you to change my life. She said, that day he really worked through you, Kevin, and it changed everything for me. Without your kindness, I don't know where I would be today. Officer Osborne says, you know, a lot of people think that police are bad. He said, just trying to help her out, show her that people do care. Doesn't matter where you came from. So in the right place, at the right time, willing and able to do the right thing. Officer Osborne there in Chattanooga, Tennessee, Kevin Osborne, we thank you, sir, for your good deed. That is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company. Thank you for being a part of the program today. Hopefully we'll be able to connect with Sheriff Scott Jenkins on tomorrow's program, get you caught up on the latest doings in the state of Virginia in the aftermath of the defeat of House Bill 961. Don't forget, you can subscribe to Town Hall Media at YouTube. Never miss a program. Also, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, townhall.com's podcast page. You can become a VIP member of Bearing Arms at bearingarms.com as well. Get exclusive analysis, commentary, and more, and help to support the Second Amendment journalism that we do each and every day. Thank you again for tuning into the program. Have a great rest of your 2A Tuesday. We'll see you back here tomorrow with another edition of Bearing Arms, Cam and Company.